everyone, Megan Marie here. Thanks for tuning in to the Crystal Habit Podcast, Episode 7. This episode, we have a couple of very cool segments for you. The first is called Creating a Cutscene, and we'll have our creative director in here to talk about exactly that, the process of creating a cutscene in-game. After that, we have the Take 5 with Carl. He'll stick around for that. And I think it's quite an enlightening segment, this episode. So definitely tune in for his answers to several questions that I've heard repeatedly, and I'm very excited to finally get you guys definitive answers for. And last, we have a crowdsource segment featuring audio clips from webmasters worldwide talking about why they love Lara, which we thought would be a fun little way to tie in the podcast to the recent Valentine's Day holiday. So stick around and enjoy. I'm very excited for the first segment of our show, which is called Creating a Cutscene. What I like about these segments is that I get to learn right alongside you guys, because this is all new to me. So I have with me Noah Hughes, who's our creative director. Hello, Noah.
Hello.
Would you be able to walk me through kind of almost like a timeline of from beginning to end of what you do before we kind of get down to the nitty-gritty of creating a cutscene and getting these into the games?
Just to walk through our high-level process, we'll start with a metascript. Generally, we map out the story that we want to tell. From there, we go into a script writing phase where we'll do several iterations of the script. From that point, we'll break it down into the scenes that we intend to shoot. We will storyboard those particular scenes. We do a practice shoot with the actors at the motion capture stage. From that, we'll iterate on the script. So we'll do a revision based on how the scene was playing. We'll also learn more about the staging of the actors and where we want the camera in the particular scene, so that when we come back in and do the final shoot, we really have a clear understanding of where we want the actors and where we want the camera and things like that. We will iterate in from that session. We'll actually get rough motion data. So we'll cut together a version of the scene based on the practice data, make any last minute changes to the script from that, then go back into the motion capture studio with the actors, this time with the full audio capture and the full set design and all of that, and do a capture of the motion and voice of the actors playing that particular scene. We then bring that back in-house and do things like lighting and textures and refining the motion and all of that. And that's basically, I guess, the high-level process.
And then it winds up in the game. So how many people are involved in creating a cutscene? So what departments have a hand in it, aside from, you said you talked about talent, and then you talked about, you know, obviously your involvement as a creative director.
Yeah, I mean, we have a lot of people touch it at different stages. So we have stakeholders on the team who participate in really the overall story that we're going to tell, and I will work closely with the writer and the cinematic director to sort of turn that into script and storyboards. And then obviously we have a lot of talent, professionals at the stage and the actors and things like that. And then once that data is captured, we work with an external animation groups who will take that data and clean it up. And things like that. That's, I think, lots of animators touching it at that point. Mm-hmm. When we bring it in-house, we have less people. At that point, we're building our sets. We have a group of a few people who are helping with the getting the animation on the actual rigs that we have and polishing. So we have our character group who's essentially making the characters and making their visuals final, and a few people who are making the cinematic sets art final and the lighting and things like that. And then we have an audio department who's doing the mix. So I guess at any given stage, it's usually in the hands of a few people, but by the time it's gone through the whole process, it's been touched by, I don't know, what, 30, 40 people or something.
Wow. Right? And at what point in time do you implement these cutscenes into a game? Because I know, you know, looking at early footage, you see those storyboards that are just kind of panned across to give you an idea of what's going to be there as a placeholder. So when do you try to implement the final cutscenes?
Getting all of the cutscenes in around our alpha milestone is important so that we can start really judging the story of the game in the context of how it's actually going to be told. But as you mentioned, before that, we make sure to integrate storyboards and other stand-ins for the cinematics so that we can start to understand how it transitions in and out of gameplay and what the pace is going to feel like and those types of things. But really, alpha is when our cinematics really start to drop in.
And at that point in time, are they locked? Do they still have the ability to change if necessary?
Yeah, I mean, they're a little more locked than a lot of our content because we're really trying to keep the captured data that we have. But at the same time, there's a fair amount of iteration that happens with cameras. The performance is happening in a way that's hard to change, that if you change one character, then they won't interact correctly with another character. But having said that, the camera can be changed and just view that scene from a different angle. So we have a fair amount of liberties with playing with camera after the capture. But we also have done a lot of captured cameras. So even those we don't like to touch too much because we're trying to keep the sort of organic feel of the hand captured cameras. But that is something that we'll iterate on. Additionally, we'll do an ADR session or essentially some dialogue replacement. So if there's particular line performances that are a bit rough or if we'd like to change a line, we can do some of that in the home stretch as well. And then things like lighting don't even happen until sort of later in the process. So we really iterate on that a lot to get the mood and just the cool final polish.
Yeah, that it's interesting seeing them progress. It's something that I hadn't been privy to before, so it's cool seeing them layered and layered and layered until you get the end result.
It's kind of scary because at first they're pretty much a disaster until it all starts coming together.
But then they function as placeholders, and then, yeah, like you said, the puzzle pieces fit together, and it's impressive. I think a lot of our fans are actually quite interested in the motion capturing process. And obviously we haven't revealed who the voice actress is yet, so we don't get to say who's running around in the black suit. But so these people are they in the traditional black suits with the little balls all over and how is, what can you kind of set the stage of what the motion capture stage looks like?
Yeah, the motion capture stage is it's pretty cool. It's just a huge square warehouse stage type feeling thing. But it's got sort of a carpeted floor and a grid on it so that we can use that for marking out the scene. And then the actors, as you mentioned, they're in the jumpsuits with the little balls. And the sets are built out of just rough materials that we need the physical form of the sets to be there. So we'll have, the stage itself is very clean with thousands of cameras, or I guess hundreds of cameras placed all around it. But then there's at least as large an area that's just full of wood planks and pillars and boards
kind
and
of build your
apple
own
boxes.
Set.
Yeah. And
okay.
So we kind of, it's almost like a carpenter's Lego set for building kind of the physical form of the set that we need. But it's, it looks more Tron-like than Tomb Raider-like. Sort of. It doesn't look much like the game when we're actually doing it on the set, obviously.
It's very interesting, though. So we capture, you said that we capture the voice and motion simultaneously, correct?
That's correct, yeah.
So what are the benefits of doing that in terms of character performance?
For us, it was pretty important to try to really have the actors benefit from playing off of each other. So obviously their ability to act in the scene together, but also even be giving that vocal performance as they're giving the physical performance, that I think you get nuances out of all of that happening at the same time that you don't necessarily get when you try to break that up into to different stages. Mm-hmm. As I mentioned, it's fine for us to do some pickup lines in a booth and stuff like that, but really the ability to hear exertions underneath a line, if someone's straining as they're delivering it, or even just the little bit of stepping on a line that you get between two actors as they're playing off of each other, that there's a lot of nuance that we like to try to capture in the moment.
And how do you capture some of these more like grand action sequences, like jumping or falling or that? Or is that all captured, or is some of that keyframed?
We try to capture as much of that as we can. We have stunt actors as well. So we have a stunt Lara and some other actors. So we will do any number of things. I guess we had, you know, wires hanging from the struts in the ceiling, or we had trampolines where they were doing head over heels flips to capture explosions and things like that. So, but like you would do in a standard sort of movie shoot, you break the scene up mm-hmm. into different bits. So one contiguous action sequence would actually be done in little snippets. So that moment where the explosion goes off, that will be one capture where we'll get the stunt actors flying through the air. And then as we edit it together, it becomes that contiguous action scene. But
this sounds like a lot of fun. I need to come down and see one of these stages.
It actually
stunts
is
hanging
fun.
From the ceiling.
Yeah.
So how often do you need to go down there? Like, how do you do a couple of very full days? Do you do smaller bite-sized sessions, or how often are you recording?
We tended to do about 2 or 3 days at a time, and we've done, I don't know, probably 6 or 7 of those particular sessions, with enough time in between one of them being practice and then leaving some time in to iterate on the script and do our initial edit based on the preliminary data. And then we do the final version of that shoot, and then again leave a little bit of time to prepare for the next one, get all of the props ready and things like that, and then go down and shoot the practice for the next batch. So we ended up doing 3 batches overall and doing a practice and final shoot with a little bit of test thrown in there for probably that total of about 7 different sessions.
So are you down there earlier than the actors, helping set up the stage and prepare all of that, get everything ready for the performance capturing?
Yeah, there's a decent amount of preparation. Also, the actors' time is pretty precious, that we're in games. We're used to sort of working a really long day if we need mm-hmm. to get things done, but the actors have the strict rules of how much they can work in a particular day. So what we try to do is get down there, do as much preparation as we can mm-hmm. so that as soon as the actors are in there, we're actually shooting scenes. And it's always a stress throughout the day, hoping that
checking
you're
your
going to get, yeah, are we going to get that final minute that we need to get to today?
Okay. So once you get the footage, you're talking about you have multiple cameras all over the motion capture stage. Who decides the angles and the panning and the camera view once you get all that raw footage back to the studio?
Yeah, that's actually a really fun part of the process. When I mentioned all of the cameras around the stage, those are just for tracking the motion. So they have if you look at the little shiny balls on the actor's suits, the hundreds of cameras around are really just tracking that and turning it into 3D motion. When we're actually doing the cameras for the cinematics themselves, we've already captured the actors and we're able to play them back in the 3D engine and watch the scene play out. And then we have a virtual camera which we can take into the stage. So at that point, there aren't any actors on the stage, but if you look through the virtual camera, you see the 3D characters performing. So mm-hmm. we use that virtual handheld camera, which has a little viewport, just like a regular camera would, but you're seeing into the digital version of it. And so you can move that camera around and shoot the performance from any angle you want, and then you can go ahead and start the performance from the beginning again and shoot from any other angle. So we have a cinematics director who's doing the directing of the actors on the set and then doing the directing of the cameras on the set. And so those are two different days, and the process of being able to shoot multiple cameras over and over with the same performance is pretty fun. The other things that are neat with that is that you can't do with a normal camera, for example, is you can say, for example, change the scale of the motion of the camera. So all of a sudden, it's as if you could be a 100-foot tall person, and when you move the camera around the scene, it's really more like a huge crane shot, something that in normal movie you'd need that giant crane or a helicopter or something to get. But just by changing the scale of the camera motion, you're able to move the camera in all different ways. So it's super fun part of the process.
Very cool. I have to imagine it makes it that much more rewarding when you finally see that audio layered in, or you hear the audio layered in, and the texture and the lighting and whatnot.
Yeah, and that really is the thing, is it's every piece is kind of done as a separate layer, and so the it's always very exciting to capture one layer, but you're always then anxious to get the next layer in so that you can see it all. So when we first get the capture the performance, I'm really just looking at the videos from that day. But then once we get the cameras, we can look at the camera shots. But then until you get the edits, it's not that interesting. And even once you get the edits, it's not interesting until you put it, you know. So
you see it all together.
Yeah.
And that's what everybody gets to see. They don't realize how much work goes into it. So everything is rendered totally in engine, correct? Nothing is pre-rendered or done outside?
For all of the standard cinematics in the game, we have an opening sequence, which is pre-rendered. But beyond that, we have we've really enjoyed using sort of the real-time process, and it allows us to transition seamlessly from gameplay to cinematic and have it really feel the same. And that's something that's important to our game is the whole experience should feel like an intense performance from the actors, right? And that goes in and out of gameplay. So that ability to do it in real time has been an important part of us making it feel unified.
Awesome. Well, I can't wait for everybody to get to see more of the work that you've been doing down the road. So thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, Carl, you know it's coming.
Cool, no problem.
Take five. Yes, and I'm actually extremely excited about this one because I get Carl to answer two questions that the fans have been asking quite often, and I know they're going to be very excited to get definitive answers too. So
I know they have the question on this as well because I get more tweets and more questions
emails.
On the forums and emails, and
absolutely.
I get hit up with this a lot. And every single time I walk by Megan this last week, all she keeps saying is, "What's the answer? What are we going to say?" So for all you people giving Megan crap for not answering, I'm the one who said we say nothing just yet until we communicate it correctly.
So thank you, Carl.
Megan presses me every single day to answer these questions.
Oh, so you just made my day. Thank you so much.
I always try and find excuses to have to go. Got to go to a meeting. Sorry.
But 90% of the time you do have to go to a meeting. So.
Yeah, I know.
All right. So question number one. Ready for this?
Yeah.
Does the new Lara Croft have a birthday? And if so, what is it?
No comment. Question number two.
What? That was such a loud screech.
Okay, so let me see if I can answer this in a very constructive way. When we went back to look at this new vision of Lara, obviously we tried to make sure that we position the character in the future of the character, right? So we're not looking at a year. We're looking at like the next 20 plus years. Let's say she lasts that long. Hopefully she will. We have to be very cognizant about obviously dating our character. You know, I know in the past we've had Lara's birthday is February the 14th, and it was Valentine's Day. And for the life of God of me, I don't know whoever decided that. I don't know when it was decided, whether it was a year, 5 years. Well, I know it wasn't a year. 5 years, 10 years ago, I do not know. And in all the characters that I've been studying really closely, I have tried to make sure that we give her dues, right? So we're building the game better, we're telling a story, but really there's certain personalities and certain things that I and the team here just don't feel like you need to get into that level of depth. You know, that brings a level which kind of starts to break down that fourth wall a little bit too much. And some of the examples I will give is, you look at James Bond, like, I have studied it and looked it up. He doesn't have a birthday. Batman doesn't have a birthday. The Incredible Hulk doesn't have a birthday. So it's looking at characters and kind of going, what is the rationale for having a birthday, right? We're, you know, of course we want to celebrate and everybody wants to, like, Valentine's Day has just come and we had loads to talk about. Mm-hmm. But does it necessarily mean that we have to pay homage to a fictional character on her birthday? So despite the fact that a lot of people will probably be a little bit peeved with us for not calling it out and saying, hey, February 14th, we look at it and kind of go, does she need to have a birthday? Is it something that we need to bring that level of personality? And I think the answer is no. So
I don't love Lara every day.
We love her every day. I don't want to disappoint people by kind of making them feel like we're disrespecting it and kind of saying, you know, no more. But we have looked at a lot of characters and a lot of people, a lot of games. And really, you know, my thought, and I think the team here, is that we do not want the date, the character, because you put a date on it. It's like, how old is James Bond? James Bond has been the same age for God knows how long. It's just been a different iteration of James Bond. And I think even when you look through, there's always been speculation about when James Bond was born and what his birthday was. And the same with Batman, the same with many, many other characters. So really, from our perspective, we don't want to date Lara, but, you know, we still keep her in our hearts.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for that one.
I know I'm going to get shit for it anyway, but I'm just, you know, trying to be as open and honest. And I
think that the fans will appreciate that, so thank you. All right, question number two. This one's a little easier. What sort of additional content and or replayability will we see in the new Tomb Raider game? Will there be side missions alongside the main missions?
Over the coming months, as you know, we've been sort of saying in the last podcast, we have loads more content we're going to talk about. I don't want to spoil anything. I don't want to give stuff away. But I think it's very simple to read between the lines and kind of go, look, we're Tomb Raider. Of course, this island is full of mystery. There'll be loads of other things you'll be able to do. As time progresses, we'll start to introduce you to different storylines and different facets and sort of different times that have been on the island. So, for instance, you know, you step out on that cliff and you see all those ships. Like, historically, there's ships from many different ages. You know, there's a Viking ship there. There's a Spanish longship. Is it a Spanish longship? What do you call it? Viking longship, Spanish Armada. Jeez, nearly got the mistake there. as well as, like, B-52 bombers and fishing trawlers. So, of course, there's tons of stuff that we want to talk to you about over time. But really, our core is that the next time we come back, we're going to talk to you about the progression of our character, a little bit about kind of the surroundings and the people on the island before we start getting into all of those secondary. But trust me. As with Lara Croft, Guardian of Light, as with other Tomb Raider games, there will be lots of other things to do. We're not going
to
stick
cater to your play style.
Exactly.
There's people who just want to plow through it, and there's people like me who can spend an hour and a half in one little area because I'm trying to jump on everything
exactly.
and explore everything and find everything.
Guardian of Light, I loved all the challenge tombs. And to us,
absolutely.
That was a big deal for us to make sure that the player felt like that there was more than just that main story. And I think, you know, again, read between the lines, you see what we're setting up here. So over the coming months, you'll see that there's a lot of other things that go on the island that will keep you intrigued. I'm just not going to go into it right now.
Well, the third question goes into it a little bit more, but similar parallel lines, not exactly the same. What variety of environments can we expect to find on the island? I think that some people have a fear that our game is dark and moody and scary and rainy and gross all the time and that you don't get to
and
see the
not.
Beauty. Oh, I know it's not, and that's why I can't wait for people to see more. But can you expand on that?
So one of the most important aspects of us when we start working on this game, was setting the island up as a character. Now, in order to have the island as a character, you can't just have a one-dimensioned character. You have to have a multi-dimensioned character. So therefore, you're going to come across situations on the island where, yes, you've seen dark, dank tombs, and then you've seen ships on the bay. Imagine being able to possibly get down to them. And then you see it's raining. Well, of course, you know, there's going to be so much more. There's going to be places on the island that will blow your mind. The vistas, beautiful. Again, I'm big into not spoiling things for people. I love to remark on them and let you know that stuff's coming and not to worry. But I don't want to turn around and say, oh, when she does this and she looks out on this, you'd be like, holy shit.
I think the character analogy is a very good one. The fact that it's a very multifaceted location. Because I mean, it is the game is on one island. I mean, that was one of the things, a persistent single location. So we wouldn't want it to feel like redundant and boring just because it's in one space.
And it's like, trust us, we're not going to build a game where it's in nighttime with just rain.
No.
Because we'd be very boring should we have decided to do that.
And we didn't. Rest assured. All right, the next question is there any news about trophy and achievement support?
Only the fact that it's going to be in the game, of course, because that's a big deal of every single game. So we'll try and make some easy, some very hard. But, you know, it's kind of a mute question because it's going to be in there, right? I don't think we could contractually submit a game to any first party without putting in trophy or achievements.
It's surprisingly a question I get quite often, and I think that... perhaps just hearing the reassurance is a good thing.
All right, well, maybe on this one I can answer wholeheartedly, yes, we will have trophies and achievements. What they will be right now, there's absolutely no way on this earth I know, because that doesn't happen until you have your game in a position where you can go in and play it and kind of go, oh, that's cool. Let's
That'd
make
be
that
cool
really
if you
hard
award
to
that.
Get.
Yeah.
That's a cool reward for doing that. So, you know, although it's in the back of our heads, no, it's not something at this stage that we start planning out. And then, of course, you know, you don't want to give any spoilers.
Yes.
I will be doing my best to make sure that we keep it as quiet as possible and that the xboxachievements.com, whatever that website is, doesn't get
that always breaks
it.
Them.
They always break it. They always tell people.
And then there's like storyline spoilers and I think.
Which I suppose to comment to that, we will be very cautious about making sure that the names of the achievements aren't spoilers, because I think
that's
a very important thing. It's a bummer is that, you know, when you turn around and say, you know, here's an example, and it's probably a spoiler alert. You know, like if you got an achievement in Arkham City for saying the death of Joker, you'd be like, oh no, that means he's gonna die. Well, who the hell names an achievement that? Now I know Rocksteady did not give an achievement named the death of Joker, but that's a spoiler. That's a big deal.
And there's a lot of people that go through the achievement list immediately to see all of the non-hidden achievements, so that they can make sure they've got their eye on the right activities and whatnot.
Exactly.
So.
Which is funny there, because as I said the death of Joker, Megan looked at me like as if I'd just given her a spoiler alert and she
hadn't
played it.
I played it. I know.
Funny.
All right, last question. So we bookended the take five with the hard questions. So now we're closing out on a hard one. The final question is, why have you guys gone so long without sharing any new information about the game? Is there a strategy to this?
So I would say, yes, there's a strategy behind everything we do. We do not just talk for the sake of it. It was very important to us that we time the announcement of our game as well as the information that we reveal about our game very strategically, so that we tell the story of reimagining this character. Lara's been around for a very long time, and you cannot expect that, you know, you come out 12 to 18 months before the game ships and go, you know, ta-da, here she is. She's shipwrecked on an island. And the next phase is, oh, she's getting stronger. And the next phase is, oh, she's an action-adventure hero. There has to be the right amount of time to allow everything to sink in for people to understand what we're trying to achieve. Now, with that said, we have been extremely lucky in 2011 off the back of getting the cover on Game Informer, written by none other than Megan Marie, that we had planned to sort of say, right, well, for the entire year, we will just talk about and focus on that one thing. Now, as the year progressed and we found that, you know, the 35 plus covers and all the awards at E3 and the amount of people who came to see it, it was almost a sellout concert. Every single time we did a demo, whether it be at E3 or any show, we had more people turning up than we could imagine. So we felt like we achieved our goal of communicating this new vision for Lara in the space of time, in a fraction of the space of time that we thought it would take. And we really reached a point in time where we said, okay, well, the next stage has to be that evolutionary step of Lara. What's she going to do next? So that each step of the way, you kind of feel like she's growing and growing and growing. And that's what we plan on doing now when we come back pretty soon. But as soon as we got to, like, I think it was around the September timeline, really everybody had seen it. Everybody had seen what we wanted to show. And all that happens is that in my mind, you start frustrating people because you're regurgitating the same content. You're talking about the same thing over and over and over again. And even if, as an example, you know, we had the option to release the gameplay footage narrated that we showed at E3. at some point in time, everybody has seen it, and it feels like you got nothing new to show. We have loads of new stuff to show, and we're really, really excited to get ready to doing it.
Absolutely.
We just decided that for a period of time, we did not want to keep showing the same thing because it starts to just date the product, and people kind of look at it and go, is it a one-trick pony? Is that all they do? And that's not all we do. So it has been very strategic. It was obviously a little bit... It's been a little bit longer than we had planned because we managed to achieve so much last year, which we're very proud of, and we're very, very happy that that the press and all the fans loved what we were doing. But let's just say it will not be long before we will be coming back. excuse me. We will be coming back and showing you the next phase. And trust me, from then on into the campaign, it's there's a lot of content dropping.
A lot of content, and it's not just game-specific like trailers and screenshots. We'll be talking talent.
We have loads
we'll be looking
to say.
At ancillary things and
but
all
it,
sorts
but it also,
of stuff.
But it also takes time for this new vision to settle into people. You know, like we're all fans. We're very close to it. A lot of the people who listen to this podcast have been close to it since day one. Reimagining an IP like this takes a little bit of time for it to sort of seep through all the cracks and for everybody to be aware it's happening. And we believe that when we come back in the very, very near future, we will have sufficiently sort of seeded the new vision of the reimagining, and that when we move into this next phase, people will understand where we're coming from in order to get there. These things take time.
It does take time, but it'll be worth the wait. That's what I keep telling people. The content we have coming is phenomenal. So I cannot wait to share it with you guys. And thank you for explaining that, Carl. I think it does provide a lot of insight into the motivation behind why we're doing what we're doing in the order and timeline that we're doing it.
Excellent.
Awesome. No, thank you so much.
And you see, that's only a take five. If you had a take six, that would have been, who is the voice of Lara Croft? And I would have been, that's a great sixth question, but I'm not going to answer it right now.
But you won't. All right. Thank Sorry. You.
Bye-bye.
Segment of this episode, I wanted to tie in to the recent Valentine's Day holiday, and I thought, what is better than asking the Tomb Raider webmasters, members of the official fan site program, to discuss why they love Lara. It turned out extremely cool to hear everybody's voices for the first time, to hear all the accents from all over the world, and to hear all these very similar experiences to my own. So without further ado, here are some of the webmasters from around the world talking about why they love Lara. Enjoy.
Hey everyone, this is Driver. I am a staff member on the official forums. I am a custom level builder. I live in the Czech Republic, and I'm a longtime Tomb Raider fan. What I probably like most about the games are the environments which Lara is placed in. My first ever experience with Lara, if I remember correctly, was a demo of the Venice level from Tomb Raider 2. I absolutely loved it. I instantly fell in love with the atmosphere of the game, and soon afterwards I headed to the local game store and bought Tomb Raider 1 for the original PlayStation. I've just been hooked ever since. Over the years I've played many other types of games. First person shooters, RPGs, racing games, fighting games and other adventure games. But Tomb Raider always managed to stand out to me for some reason. It's got that special something to it. I really can't explain what that is though. It's hard to really put my finger on it. So far, I liked every major installment of the game. Yes, that does include Angel of Darkness. Despite its flaws, I did like the original story which Core wanted to tell with it. I think it's a shame that the planned trilogy was never finished. It was actually funny for me chasing Eckert in Prague because I was actually in Prague at the time on vacation. I was staying at my girlfriend's parents' house, and looking out of the window I could actually see the real Strahov, which, by the way, is in reality a football stadium here, not an actual fortress. I think the atmosphere and some of the levels of Angel of Darkness were some of the best in the entire series. But still, nothing really beats the first experience of Tomb Raider 1 though. It left by far the biggest impression on me. The creepiness of the abandoned tombs, the subtle background ambience, the weird creatures in the levels, especially the ones near the end, giant alien eggs all over the place. And I especially love the awesome orchestrated soundtrack of the game. It was really something different at the time. What I also love about Tomb Raider is that it's still alive and kicking after more than 15 years now. Everyone knows Lara Croft, she's such a major icon worldwide, both in the gaming industry and outside. And finally, I love Tomb Raider for its community. I love reading all those online discussions, playing those very creative custom levels, and seeing all that awesome fan art from you guys. You guys rock! And I love how the Tomb Raider community brings people from many different backgrounds and countries together. So in the spirit of Valentine's Day, I'll end by saying thanks, Tomb Raider. I wouldn't have met my better half if it wasn't for this game.
Hello everyone, my name is Quentin. I'm the webmaster of the website TombRaiderADEC.com, a French fan site about Tomb Raider and Lara Croft. I'm a fan of Lara for almost 11 years. Lara is my idol since I'm a little boy. I started playing it on PS1 with my parents' friends who already had the 4 Tomb Raider games. I fell in love with the Tomb Raider franchise, with the action, the adventure, and especially the character, who is strong, beautiful, and intelligent. If I had to choose my 3 favorite Tomb Raider games, I think I would first say Tomb Raider The Last Revelation. This Egyptian feeling that I love. Wonderful game. Lara was beautiful and we could play as young Lara for the first time. Then I would choose Tomb Raider Legend that I had on PS2. Lara is handsome in this game. The levels are very different. The environments are awesome and the characters are lovely. The story wasn't that bad. Finally, I would say Tomb Raider The Angel of Darkness, that I also had on PS2. Lara is dark in this Tomb Raider. She's not bad, and I like the way you go through the levels without having weapons like the other games. Infiltrate, kill, pick up. I found this very good, and the Louvre was the best level of the game to me. About the upcoming Tomb Raider, I can't wait to play it. I've always dreamed about a Tomb Raider that would have to be played as a survival game where you need to eat, to drink, to pick up equipment, and especially to survive. I think about it every day. Crystal Dynamics is making a very good work. I know this Tomb Raider reboot will be great.
Hi, my name is Jessica and I'm proudly one of the site Tomb Raider Leverdit of Brazil. I love Lara Croft because she's inspired me a lot in Mary. Me learning the woman can answer will be providing reason. It's strong and always waiting more and the daddy want makes us become what it is today. For me, it's a global icon with woman.
Hey, this is Reno from Lara Croft, the Raider community. I'm from Iraq, and I want to take this opportunity to say that Lara Croft is one of the most important people in my life. She's more like a mentor and a best friend to me than just a video game character. And she's always been there for me since I first started playing Tomb Raider in 1997, which was Tomb Raider 2. And until now, Tomb Raider is one of the most important and most inspiring video games I've ever played. Lara Croft has always been there for me. Whenever I felt lonely or upset or just didn't know what to do, I turn my console on and I start playing for hours and hours. And that's what I still do till this very moment. And this led me to creating a fan site, which later became an official Tomb Raider fan site, which is more like an honor and one of the biggest achievements in my life. I want to say that I'm more than just excited about the upcoming Tomb Raider title. I think it's going to be amazing and I can't wait to play it, and I have every trust in the developers and of course in the amazing Lara Croft.
Hi, this is Katie Fleming from Katie's Tomb Raider site in Canada. I've been a huge fan of Tomb Raider for 13 years and it's my biggest passion. I love how each game brings you to unique places around the world, perfectly combining adventure, action, and puzzle solving. I have so many great memories from the games, and here are a few of my favorites. Locking Winston in the freezer, crashing the quad bike into a federal compound, discovering aliens do exist, kayaking down the River Ganges, and blowing up the speedboat in Venice. Tomb Raider is an amazing series with an incredible fan base, and I can't wait for her next adventure later this year.
Hi everyone, my name is Matt, I'm from Australia and I run TombRaiderBlog.net, and that's been going for almost a year now. I've been a Tomb Raider fan for about 14 years, and the demo from Tomb Raider 2 is what started it all for me. One of my favourite Tomb Raider moments would have to be from Tomb Raider 3 in Area 51. Towards the end of the level, Lara comes across this UFO in the facility that she's found herself in, and eventually she discovers a way to undo the trapdoor underneath the craft. Now, it looks pretty small from the outside, but on the inside it's absolutely huge, kind of like Doctor Who's TARDIS. And then there's the artifact, Element 115. It's just sitting there on the floor, unlike the other artifacts throughout the game where you practically have to kill Lara to retrieve them. So that's just one of my favourite Tomb Raider moments.
Hello, my name is Luca, I'm from Germany and I'm the maker of Tomb Raider Insider. Megan has given us the opportunity to tell you why we like Tomb Raider so much. What I like best in the games are the great and awesome worlds and places you can explore. I think that's what makes a good game. Most of all, I liked Underworld because the Thailand level is absolutely epic. I love it. In addition, Tomb Raider also offers a great and interesting story. But unfortunately, I started very late in the series, so I'm really looking forward to the reboot. And I'm really looking forward to the new Lara 2. Finally, I extend greetings to all visitors of Tomb Raider Insider and everyone I know. Thanks for listening.
Hello everybody, I'm Marco and I am the webmaster of the website allgamestuff.altervista.org. I'm Italian as well as my website, and so I apologize for my English and for my pronunciation. Well, I would really like to talk about the reasons why we love Lara Croft and Tomb Raider. Personally, I fell in love with Lara, so to say, since the first time I met her, a sort of love at first sight. Yeah, she was and she is very beautiful, but she was and she is much more than this in my opinion. I was struck, for example, by a series of other characteristics that weren't hidden by her beauty. First of all, she is very clever, she is sarcastic, she is a self-made woman, and most of all, she has made her passion her job. Some people accused Lara of being the symbol of objectification of women, but I do not believe it is true. Lara is so beloved because she's an independent woman, and she can do what most men couldn't do. These are the reasons why I love Lara Croft, and I do believe that I'm gonna appreciate the new Lara too. In my opinion, the franchise is going in the right direction. Well guys, that's all. Thanks for listening, and let's continue to follow Tomb Raider. See ya!
And that concludes our episode. So to wrap up, we do have a Tomb Raider trivia contest of sorts this month. If you've been following the blog, you know that we had a couple of technical problems, and as such, the podcast number 6 was down for about a week. Because of that, we're going to extend the trivia contest from last month to make sure that everybody has a chance to get in and answer the question, since the final question was on podcast number 6. So, to make things a little bit easier, I'm actually going to recap all 3 trivia questions right now for you, so you don't have to hunt them down on Facebook, Twitter, and the podcast. And remember, you're going to take all 3 answers, and you're going to plug them into tombraider.com/podcast. As a refresher, the prize on the line this month is a custom Tomb Raider North Face jacket that is only available to us as developers prior, and also kind of a little survival kit that we picked up from REI. So, trivia question number 1 is, in the original Tomb Raider, touching what artifact will transform Lara into solid gold? Question number 2 is, who is the ill-intentioned cosmetics tycoon from Tomb Raider 3? And question number 3 is, what is the mysterious Bermuda Triangle-esque location in which the newest Tomb Raider unfolds? Hope you got all of that, and best of luck. Till next time.